Prime. Good morning, everybody. That's good stuff. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world. Happy Monday, everybody. Today's December 8th, 2025. I hope you all had a fantastic weekend. And now begins the new week. And we are off to a running start this week. We've already got our first AI mania story of the week. IBM is buying Confluent for $11 billion, all cash. Confluent is a data streaming platform. This one kind of stands out from most of your typical announced AI deals because they're not just pumping a gajillion dollars into GPUs, using the money that you got from the guy you're buying the GPUs you got it from. This is different. This is more of a software thing. And IBM has been something of an outlier in this race. They've been a little late to the party. Some said they've missed out largely on the AI trade. But you know what they haven't done? They haven't dumped hundreds of billions of dollars in wasted CapEx into hardware. So this deal is kind of interesting. Now, Confluent, again, it's a data streaming, data management firm. They IPO'd in 2021. They're down like 80% off of their IPO's high here. But the stock is up this morning. They're getting a nice premium off their last closing price. We've also got another deal being announced this morning. CoreWeave, my favorite company in the world to talk about what wonderful financial degenerates they are over at CoreWeave. Well, they are issuing $2 billion in convertible notes. All right, so we've got more debt, maybe more dilution, while the company executives and founders continue to dump shares of that stock every single day. There are more and more SEC filings about the founders and executives dumping that stock hand over fist. Gee, who could have seen that one coming? Interesting, though, they're using some of the proceeds of this $2 billion for what they're calling a capped call transaction. This is kind of interesting. They're claiming that they're going to offset the risk of diluting the stock by buying calls in their own stock. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I don't know what the hell they're doing. All I can tell you is these guys are creative. These guys have sharp pencils. And whenever they get funky like this, innocent people tend to lose money. Take a look at a ticker, SYSX, Sysrex, if you think I'm kidding. I've talked about this name in a couple of videos. CoreWeave got involved with them and did some kind of cockamamie reverse triangular merger. Stock rallies thousands of percent and then dumps. CoreWeave made a lot of money. People who followed them into the trade got wiped out. So we got that one going on this morning. We've got more problems at OpenAI. There was an article over the weekend. Man, you can really see the narrative around OpenAI has shifted here. They're becoming a liability more than an asset for this market and for any companies that are doing a lot of business with them. The OpenAI basket of stocks is way down since the high seen in September, thanks in no small part to Google and their TPUs and the successful launch of Gemini 3, which was much better than the laughing stock that was GPT-5. And OpenAI is out with a report this morning that says AI is saving the average worker an hour every day. Now, that's interesting because it flies in the face of similar studies that we've seen from MIT that said work slop is wasting millions of dollars at the average company and that people hate it and it's causing animosity and social problems between workers. And 95% of the companies that are trying AI are not making any money out of it. And most of them are actually losing money. The fact that OpenAI is releasing this study that says the average worker is saving an hour, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the tobacco companies telling people that cigarettes are not addictive and they're totally good for you. But hey, that's just my take on this one. Meanwhile, we've got more news this morning from the trade war. The long-anticipated aid for farmers is expected to be announced today. President Trump is expected to announce $12 billion in aid for farmers. Now, this will be under the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program, which is basically direct subsidies, one-time payments to farmers to offset the pain from the trade war. Also interesting, he will not be going through Congress to get this money. He's using something called the Commodity Credit Corp Charter Act, some obscure legal basis for making these payments. We'll see if there's any challenge to this or if they're just going to go ahead with it. Look, they're also mentioning in this article about this how the Chinese have bought 2.25 million tons of soybeans from the United States this year. They promised in the latest trade deal, not trade deal, back in October, that before the end of the year, they were going to buy 12 million tons of soybeans. We are now almost a third of the way through September. We're now almost a third of the way through December, and they have bought 2.25 tons. Not even a quarter of what they've promised to do by year end. I'm beginning to think the Chinese are full of shit. I know, crazy, right? It's almost like they don't keep their promises in trade deals. And what's the point of even making trade deals with people who never keep their end of the deal? But I digress. Hey, shout out to all the Xi bots that are in my comments every time I say something mean about China. Thank you for the engagement. We've also got an article in CNBC about beef prices soaring and how it's kind of a double-edged sword for beef producers. The beef herd is at the lowest it's been since 1951. And look, there's a lot more people than there were in 1951, and you got the same amount of cows to feed a whole lot more people. Yeah, the price goes higher when that happens. But talking about some of the problems like drought and disease and bottlenecks at meatpackers that are affecting beef producers, that was an interesting read this morning. President Trump says the Netflix Warner Brothers deal could be a problem, suggesting he might block the merger that we talked about on Friday between Netflix and Warner Brothers. Now, they're talking about how it would create a single company that controls 30% of the market for streaming if you were to combine Netflix and HBO Max. Meanwhile, we've got movie producers are anonymously lobbying Congress to block the merger, talking about the damage it will do to theaters. And they're being anonymous because they're worried that Netflix might retaliate against their movies if they come out and speak publicly. And it's kind of interesting because movie producers get together at these award shows and make their stupid political speeches in front of the cameras. And they always congratulate each other on being so stunning and so brave about the issues that they take on. But when there's money at stake, they hide behind anonymity. Isn't that interesting? By the way, I agree with the premise of their letter that the Netflix Warner Brothers merger is going to be catastrophic for the theater business, something I talked about on Friday. But when there's dollars on the line, the whole stunning and brave thing, that goes away real freaking fast. See also how they bend over backwards for Chinese censors every single time. What else we got? China's exports this morning. This is a crazy story here. Exports in China are up 5.7% year over year. I'm sorry. Up 5.7% year over year, even though exports to the United States are down 29%. Now, you might ask, how could their exports possibly be up when the largest economy in the world is down by 29%? Number one, they're either lying, which Chinese government statistics lie. No, let's rule out that crazy possibility. Tinfoil hat wearing SOBs you. It's also entirely plausible that they're doing transshipment, that they're just increasing their shipment. They're manufacturing things in China, sending them to countries like Vietnam, repackaging them, and then shipping them to the United States. Something that there was supposed to have been enforcement mechanisms in some of these trade deals we cut with these other countries in order to block that from happening, looks like it's not working. Just another example of the trade deal has been somewhat haphazard, clumsy even. We got an article about SRTs, significant risk transfers, or synthetic risk transfers, if you want. I've heard them called either one. I think they're avoiding calling them synthetic risk transfers because it reminds people of synthetic CDOs and it gives them the heebie-jeebies, and rightly so. It's a trillion-dollar market, and it's interesting. Where is that $1 trillion coming from? Synthetic risk transfers, significant risk transfers. It's how banks get the risk off their balance sheet. But where is the money coming from for these SRTs? Oh, Wall Street, you just never cease to amaze me with your stupidity. And of course, we've got shooting has broken out once again between Cambodia and Thailand. That is the second time this year as the world slowly marches backwards into World War III. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget that like button. You new guys, hit that subscribe button so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads because we do this every single day. Right now, the S&P 500 is up 10 points, 0.15%. Not a whole lot of movement in stocks this morning. The Dow is up 42 points or 0.09%. It was in the red a few minutes ago. Looks like it's catching a bid now. And the NASDAQ futures are up 83 points, not percent. You wish. Calm down, AI bros. Up 83 points, 0.34% higher ahead of the opening bell. The DXY is off by 3 basis points this morning, 98.96 for the U.S. dollar. Not a lot of movement there. And we have got bonds are marginally lower this morning, yields a little bit higher. The 30-year Treasury, 4.793, that's up a tenth of a point. The 10 years at 4.146, up about a half a point. The two-year yield at 3.579, that's up a point and a half. And the 1 month is up 1 point at 3.729. The Fed is expected to cut rates on Wednesday of this week. And speaking of bonds and interest rates, guys, something you really got to keep an eye out. These Japanese borrowing costs, they are not slowing down. 1.974 is the yield on the 10-year JGB or Japan government bond. And look at this move over the last six or seven sessions. It's heading higher and it is accelerating higher as we go. Remember that yen carry trade where people borrow cheap money in Japan, convert the yens to dollars, use the dollars to buy U.S. assets like stocks and crypto. If the borrowing costs in Japan keep going higher, that yen carry trade could unwind. And the last time that happened was August 5th of 2024. Go take a look at what stocks did at that point. Oh, my God. It's another thing to keep an eye on here. By the way, the crypto bubble, the AI bubble, all highly vulnerable to this yen carry trade. Looking over at the commodities board, we've got a little bit of a mixed bag. Not a lot of movement in commodities this morning. Spot gold is up 11 bucks at $4,208, about a quarter of a percent higher. February gold futures are at 42.37. That's down by 5 bucks or 0.12%. Spot silver is lower by about a penny here, $58.29. Meanwhile, March COMEX silver futures are at 58.73, off by about 32 cents or 0.55%, but I still like the shiny. Copper is down about 2 cents, 5.44 for copper futures after hitting an all-time high on Friday. Copper futures are starting to be some worry about geopolitical dislocations, supply squeezes resulting from that. Copper has had a heck of a run this year. Platinum is up by 0.4%. Palladium is higher by 2.3%. And crude oil is off by about 1.5%. 59.17 for WTI crude futures in January. That's lower by about 91 cents. Looking over at Bitcoin, it was up and down pretty much all weekend here. We're currently sitting at $91,460, this band that we've been in for a couple of days here. Saying it's higher by about $1,000. I did see a story that Michael Saylor bought 10,000 Bitcoin between December 1st and December 7th. He probably shouldn't be doing that if he's having to borrow money in order to make sure he can service his debt costs during crypto winter. But Michael Saylor's the kind of guy who just can't help himself. All right, let's talk about this one. Trump to unveil $12 billion in long-awaited farm aid program. The farmers are finally getting a little bit of relief here. Emphasis a little bit, and it's coming very late in the year. The Trump administration on Monday plans to unveil a long-awaited farm aid package, according to a White House official, offering $12 billion in assistance to a key base of support hit hard by low crop prices and the impact of the president's tariff policies. The aid will include up to $11 billion in one-time payments to crop farmers under the Department of Agriculture's newly designed Farmer Bridge Assistance Program, while the remaining is reserved for crops not covered under the FBA, according to the official, who asked not to be identified. The aid comes amid rising frustration among farmers on the slow pace of Chinese purchases, with Beijing clamped down on earlier this year in retaliation for Trump's escalating tariff barrage. You can see here in this chart, guys, showing in black, that's what the Chinese have actually bought, 2.25 million tons of soybeans since October 30th. And then the entire pie here is what they promised to buy by the end of the year. So since the end of October, they have bought 2.25 million tons. They've still got 9.75 tons that they would have to buy in the next 22, 23 days, which includes a lot of holidays in order to keep their promises. I'm beginning to think they're not going to keep that promise. The funds for the new program have been authorized under the Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act, and will be administered by the Farm Service Agency, according to the official. The interesting thing about that is it would suggest that this is not funds that President Trump is going to have to go ask Congress for. They've already been allocated, already been authorized. No word about any challenges, legal or anything. So it looks like this is going to happen pretty quick. Trump had earlier floated a plan to use tariff revenue for the program, the announcement of which had been delayed by a government shutdown. And then we got this one. This is an interesting article in CNBC talking about what's going on with beef prices. You guys may have known the price of a steak, the price of ground beef, hamburger has been ridiculous over these last couple of months. Beef prices are soaring. Here's why America is facing record low cattle numbers. By the way, that steak just looks fantastic. My God, the marble in that steak. Feed me. Shoppers may be feeling sticker shock with the cost of beef at the grocery store. Prices in the beef and veal category are up 14.7%, while overall food is up 3.1% from September through September. Well, year over year for September. 14.7% hike in beef prices. Yikes. That's according to the latest publicly available consumer price index data due to the government shutdown in October. For all we know, it's a lot worse than that. But expenses for America's farmers are soaring too. Input costs for ranchers are up more than 50% over the past 5 years, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. It's hard as a beef producer to necessarily say that beef prices are too high. I mean, if people are paying $6 for a latte at Starbucks, but then they're paying $6 for a pound of beef, they're able to feed their family for a family of three with that pound of beef, says Taylor Lineman, co-owner of Linetics Ranch in Princeton, Nebraska. I guess he's kind of defending these higher prices here. That's not really working. A major driver of the rising prices of beef prices stems from a record low cattle supply. The start of 2025 saw the smallest national herd since 1951. Yikes, 75-year low for the number of cattle in America. The cattle cycle is the natural expansion and contraction of the U.S. cattle herd, which is tied to supply and demand. It typically occurs every 8 to 12 years. When producers get higher prices for their cattle, they will likely retain more females, called heifers, for breeding. When the cattle supply increases, prices eventually go down and the herds contract again. It's a big question right now for our producers. You know, they have a 50-50 decision to make. Do we sell the cattle off into the supply system or do we hold them back? And I think when the money is on the table, there's an incentive to go ahead and sell those to the food supply system, especially when demand is so high from the consumer, said Adam Wagner, director of marketing at the Nebraska Beef Council. Severe drought can also impact the decision for a rancher to retain cattle for breeding. When you're in a drought, you're producing minimal feed and hay or alfalfa, Lineman said. The amount of cattle that are out there are still out there, and they're still needing that feed. During times of drought, ranchers will often supplement grass feed with grain, but grain prices have come down significantly since 2022, but it can still be an unexpected cost for producers. And they zeroed in on 2022 there. I think that's important. Remember, in 2022, the price of corn, the price of soybeans, all the row crops just went vertically up with the inflation and then the fertilizer shortage. At the same time, there was a big drought down south. So it was just next to impossible for the ranchers to feed their herd. So what did a lot of them do? They sold their heifers, their girls. And what do you, when you don't have girls, you know what you don't have? You don't have little baby cows. You don't have any calves coming in now. 3 years later, the herd is the smallest it's been since 1951. And what's worse than that, because of the bottleneck at the meat packers, it's not mentioned in this article. It's kind of suspicious they didn't mention this, but there was a big bottleneck in meat packers. So the ranchers that were selling those cattle back in 2022 were getting next to nothing for what they were selling because they were limiting the capacity at the meat packers, using COVID as an excuse to shut down plants. And so the ranchers were getting pennies on the dollar for what their cattle should have been worth. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Here we are several years later. The herd is the smallest since 1951, and nobody can afford a steak anymore. Meanwhile, we got some I am tongue-tied this morning. I'm sorry, guys. It's Monday. Forgive me. We've got some AI stories going on this morning. IBM to buy Confluent for $11 billion to expand AI services. No GPUs, no circular financing, just a computer company buying a software company. This deal is almost refreshing. I'm not going to lie. IBM is buying the data streaming platform Confluent for $11 billion, including debt, marking one of its largest takeovers yet and a major bet on the kind of enterprise software that artificial intelligence tools need to perform tasks in real time. IBM has agreed to buy Confluent for $31 a share, according to a statement issued Monday. That represents an equity value of around $9.3 billion, according to Bloomberg calculations. The company expects the deal to close by the middle of 2026. Confluent shares rose around 27% to $30.66 in pre-market trading. That's just below the offer price. Trading for the stock was halted soon after the announcement. IBM fell 1.7%. The AI boom has touched off billions of dollars in deals for businesses that build, train, or leverage technology, propelling the value of an entire ecosystem of data center developers, software makers, generative AI tool developers, and data management firms. Mountain View, California-based Confluence sits in the data corner of that world, providing a platform for companies to gather or stream and analyze data in real time as opposed to shipping data in clunkier batches. Manufacturers such as Michelin, for example, have used Confluence platform to optimize their inventories of raw and semi-finished materials live. Instacart adopted Confluent to develop real-time fraud detection systems and gain more visibility into the availability of products sold on its grocery delivery platform. Businesses are increasingly tapping AI systems that manage tasks like this in real time and require live flows of data to do so. Confluent stock is up 29.1%. Trading at $29.88, looks like it's still halted here, up $6.74. Also worth pointing out, guys, when we zoom out on this chart, you can see Confluent hasn't really done so well. It's down 47.4% since its IPO. It's off almost 80% since its high post-IPO. This is a company that, despite all the hoopla in that Bloomberg article, hasn't really done very well. And, well, if you bought up here, once this IBM deal closes, you're locking in those losses. Meanwhile, my favorite outfit in the whole wide world, CoreWeave shares fall on $2 billion convertible notes offering. They're borrowing money and they're diluting their shareholders while the executives cash out. Who could have seen this coming? CoreWeave shares fell after the company unveiled plans to raise $2 billion by issuing debt that can be exchanged for shares. This company's already like $13 billion in debt, by the way. You can add two more to that. Shares fell as much as 7% to $82.10 in pre-market trading. The artificial intelligence computing firm will issue the convertible notes due 2031 in a private offering with an option to increase the deal by an extra $300 million. CoreWeave, which held its IPO in March, has attracted investors looking to bet on the explosion in AI spending. The Livingston, New Jersey-based company is a close partner of AI chipmaker NVIDIA. Some might say it's an off-balance sheet special purpose vehicle for NVIDIA, but I digress. And they count OpenAI and Microsoft among their customers. Now, this is interesting here. The firm will use part of the proceeds to enter into a derivatives transaction intended to reduce the risk of diluting its stock if the notes convert into shares. The rest of the proceeds will be used to help keep its business running. Wait, help keep its business running? Oh, that's right. They lose money hand over fist and they're nowhere near making a profit. I almost forgot about that. I'm sorry. But that first sentence there, using part of the proceeds to enter into a derivatives transaction intended to reduce the risk of diluting their stock, that's called a capped call transaction, guys. They're borrowing all this money that, you know, eventually the debt could be converted into shares. They'll almost certainly be converted into shares. And so they're essentially buying call options on their own stock with the money that they're borrowing. I don't know what the hell this is, honestly. But I can tell you, anytime these guys get creative like this, innocent people lose money. I've seen this with Cicerex. This cannot be good for shareholders, and they're not acting like it's good for them. CoreWeave stock is down 5%, $83.94, down about $4.30. Still, though, almost double its IPO price. That is amazing to me that so many people bought this silly story, hook, line, and sinker. This one is a goose egg long term. Meanwhile, OpenAI goes from stock market savior to burden as AI risks mount. Boy, what a shift in the narrative, huh? That escalated kind of quickly. Stock market savior to burden. AI risks mount. Wall Street sentiment toward companies associated with artificial intelligence is shifting, and it's all about two companies. OpenAI is down, and Alphabet is up. The maker of ChatGPT is no longer seen as being on the cutting edge of AI technology and is facing questions about its lack of profitability and the need to grow rapidly to pay for its massive spending commitments, which it can't pay for. Meanwhile, Google's parent is emerging as a deep-pocketed competitor with tentacles in every part of the AI trade. OpenAI was the golden child earlier this year, and Alphabet was looked at in a very different light, said Brett Ewing, chief market strategist at First Franklin Financial Services. Now sentiment is much more tempered towards OpenAI. As a result, the shares of companies in OpenAI's orbit, principally Oracle, CoreWeave, and AMD, but also Microsoft, NVIDIA, and SoftBank, which has an 11% stake in the company, are coming under heavy selling pressure. Meanwhile, Alphabet's momentum is boosting not only its stock price, but also those associated with it, like Broadcom, Lumen Holdings, Celestica, and TTM Technologies. The shift has been dramatic in magnitude and speed. Just a few weeks ago, OpenAI was sparking huge rallies in any company related to it. Now those connections look more like an anchor. It's a change that carries wide-ranging implications given how central the closely held companies have been to the AI mania that has driven the stock market's three-year rally. And the fact that Bloomberg is using the language AI mania there just feels like such a win. Oh my, for years, I've heard them just endlessly grab their pom-poms and cheer on this bubble. Finally, someone is using the phrase AI mania. I said it first. I want a nickel every time somebody does it. A light has been shined on the complexity of the financing, the circular deals, the debt issues. Nobody saw that coming, Ewing said. I'm sure this exists around the Alphabet ecosystem to a certain degree, but it was exposed as pretty extreme for OpenAI's deals, and appreciating that was a game changer for sentiment. By the way, guys, just want to mention I am short NVIDIA since I mentioned NVIDIA a little bit in that article, full disclosure and all. Meanwhile, OpenAI finds AI saves workers nearly an hour a day on average. And in totally unrelated news, cigarettes are not addicting and are not bad for your health, right? Isn't that how that works? OpenAI's artificial intelligence products are saving workers an average of about 40 to 60 minutes a day on professional tasks, according to a large survey conducted by the ChatGPT maker amid lingering skepticism of the economic benefits of AI. Yes, person selling products says product is good. More news at 11. Employees in industries such as data science, engineering, and communications, as well as certain roles like accounting, reported some of the most time saved from using AI, according to OpenAI's survey of 9,000 workers across 100 companies. The fact that accounting is in that list terrifies me, by the way. If you're ever using any of these large language models, be careful with numbers, be careful with math. The hallucinations, once you go from language into numbers, the hallucinations are off the charts. I shudder to think about what AI will do in the world of accounting. 3/4 of employees said that using AI at work has improved either the speed or quality of their output, the survey found. 3 years into the AI boom, doubts persist about whether how much AI will boost work productivity. In August, researchers at MIT found that the vast majority of organizations saw zero return on their investment in generative AI initiatives. The next month, researchers at Harvard and Stanford universities determined that professionals are using AI to create work slop, which they defined as AI-generated work content that masquerades as good work but lacks the substance to meaningfully advance a given task. Those findings have added to concerns about a possible bubble as tech firms race to spend billions on a technology with an unknown payoff. OpenAI and other prominent artificial intelligence companies have since pushed out their own research and evaluations to showcase the technology's economic impact. Last week, OpenAI rival Anthropic released a report estimating that its AI tool, Claude, cut down the time it takes for people to commit work tasks by 80%, among other findings. The results were based on an analysis of 100,000 user conversations. These reports are not peer-reviewed. Guys, this is marketing material. This is not a study. This is not science. This is marketing. And this is no different than a cigarette company saying their product is not addictive. Meanwhile, we got a couple of stories this morning about this Netflix Warner Brothers deal. Trump says Netflix huge deal for Warner Brothers could be a problem. That's interesting, kind of hinting that he might block it. Comments by President Trump on Sunday raised an antitrust red flag over Netflix's $72 billion deal to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery. Speaking to reporters before an event at the Kennedy Center in Washington, Trump said a combination between the largest and fourth largest streaming services in the U.S. could be a problem. They have a very big market share, Trump told reporters, referring to Netflix. And when they have Warner Brothers, that share goes up a lot. I'll be involved in that decision, Trump added. A combined Netflix and HBO Max would control roughly 30% of the U.S. streaming market, though Netflix has argued that platforms such as YouTube, TikTok, and Facebook should be added to the mix as rivals for viewership, which would greatly dilute Netflix's market share. That's right, Netflix. You're no match for nobody special. F and A cotton. But this is not the only article critical of the Netflix-Warner Brothers merger. We've got a bunch of stunning and brave movie producers who are afraid to put their names on a letter here. Anonymous A-listers lobby Congress against Netflix-Warner Brothers acquisition. Streamer would hold a noose around the theatrical marketplace. A consortium of top industry players have sent an open letter full of alarm to Congress, describing a potential economic and institutional meltdown in Hollywood if Netflix succeeds in its effort to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery. The letter was sent via email to members of Congress from both parties on Thursday from an anonymous collective identifying themselves only as concerned feature film producers. The group explained it was leaving the letter unsigned, not out of cowardice, but fear of retaliation, given Netflix's considerable power as a buyer and distributor. Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery declined to comment. By the way, what's the difference between cowardice and fear of retaliation? Aren't we saying the same thing here? One has more of a pejorative context, but yeah, fear is the root of cowardice. I'm just saying. One well-placed source confirmed to Variety that the group includes a number of prominent filmmakers. The communication outlines three areas of great concern, including that Netflix could stand to destroy the theatrical film marketplace by escalating or eliminating the amount of time Warner Brothers films would play in theaters before hitting a combined Netflix-HBO Max streaming platform. Sources told Variety earlier on Thursday that Netflix's current proposal for Warner Brothers would have a theatrical window as thin as 2 weeks of exclusivity before moving to streaming. Another insider familiar with the deal process flatly denied this, saying the periods would be longer. Rival bidders Comcast and Paramount both have robust theatrical distribution outlets. Paramount has specifically pledged to keep Warner Brothers operating as a standalone business that will make a minimum of 14 films per theaters per year. By the way, Paramount and Warner Brothers, them merging, that's two of the biggest studios in Hollywood merging. So you have your own antitrust concerns along with that deal if that had gone through. The producers argue that Netflix would effectively hold a noose around the theatrical marketplace with what they assert would be enough market influence to reduce the footprint of theatrical movies and force down subsequent licensing fees paid in post-theatrical windows. And that was my first reaction on Friday when I saw this deal was announced, was that movie theaters are going to be hardest hit by this one. It seems the producers see the same thing happening there. Meanwhile, we've got China exports to the U.S. extend double-digit declines, dropping 29% in November despite the trade truce. China's U.S.-bound goods fell for an eighth straight month despite a recent trade deal between the two economies, even as overall exports surpassed market expectations in November as manufacturers loaded up on shipments to other markets. Outbound shipments surged 5.9% last month in U.S. dollar terms from a year earlier. China's customs data showed Monday, topping economists' forecast for 3.8% growth in a Reuters poll. That growth marked a rebound from an unexpected 1.1% drop in October, the first contraction since March of 2024. So shipments to the U.S. down 29%, but shipments in total up 6%. How is that possible? Well, exports to the U.S. plunged 28.6% in November, marking the eighth straight month of double-digit declines in shipments to the world's largest consumer market. Even as President Xi Jinping and his U.S. counterpart Donald Trump reached a deal in South Korea in late October, imports from America shrank 19% from a year earlier. Despite the trade truce, the U.S. still imposes higher tariffs on China than many other countries, said Gary. How do you pronounce that? N-G. I don't even, Gary N. I don't even, there's no vowels. How do you pronounce that? Sorry, guys, I don't get out much. He's the senior economist at Natixis, adding that Chinese exporters have likely continued to utilize their facilities in third markets to export to the U.S. It can become a future norm, this guy noted. Again, I can't get over that. There's no vowels in his name. How do you pronounce that? Levies on Chinese goods remain at around 47.5%, according to Peterson Institute for International Economics. Beijing's tariffs of imports in the U.S. stand at around 32%. Guys, here's what's happening here. Chinese, he said it in this one, Chinese exporters have likely continued to utilize their facilities in third markets to export to the U.S. That's transshipments. All right. All these deals we cut, in particular, the big deal we cut with the Vietnamese earlier this year, was supposed to have robust enforcement mechanisms in place to prevent Chinese transshipment. And that is obviously not working. The Chinese are getting around the tariffs by selling their goods to countries with lower tariffs, and then they sell them to the United States. All right. Meanwhile, WTF is going on with banks. This article just cracked me up this morning. Banks love significant risk transfers, and that has regulators worried. And they should be worried. This is unbelievable. This is like Steve Carell with his hair messed up, levels of stupidity and fraud going on with these significant risk transfers. Banks have been in a bind. They want to make more loans so they can better compete against non-banking lenders and boost profits, but they've been hindered by tighter rules imposed after the 2008 financial crisis that require them to hold aside extra money to cover potential losses on the loans they've already made. This leaves less fresh capital available to pursue new lending or expand the company. Increasingly, banks are turning to financial instruments, the significant risk transfer, or SRT, that cuts the amount of risk on their books, freeing up money that they held in reserve and allowing them to make new loans and investments. SRTs are essentially an insurance policy for banks who pay third parties, such as hedge funds, to agree to cover some of the bank's losses if the loans in question don't get repaid. Also known as synthetic risk transfers, the deals allow banks to offload risk, typically without selling the underlying assets because they're afraid of what they're worth. SRTs already cover billions of dollars worth of loans, and more are being created almost every week. That's especially true in Europe, where financial regulators are increasingly concerned that some banks could be fast increasing their reliance on SRTs and eventually putting the stability of lenders in the wider financial system at risk. So real quick, an SRT, guys, it's basically an insurance policy, but it's cash up front. If you're a hedge fund or a pension fund and you buy an SRT, you take a sum of money, a lump of cash, and you put it into escrow. And then the bank pays you a regular interest rate on that money. And then if the loans default, the bank keeps that money. So they have effectively transferred the risk off their balance sheet to the hedge fund or to the pension fund. And in exchange for taking that risk, the pension fund or the hedge fund collects an interest payment from the bank. All right. It sounds good, right? The banks, they're now free to make more loans. The risk is off their balance sheet. Here's the thing. Where are the hedge funds getting the money to buy those SRTs? The money that's being set aside to cover the losses for the banks. Where is that money coming from? Regulators are concerned that instead of removing the risk from banks, SRTs are masking risk by spreading it to other financial firms. Some investors rely heavily on borrowed money to help finance their purchase of SRT notes using bank loans to post the required collateral, according to the IMF. If those SRT investors get into financial trouble and can't repay their loans, the risk winds up back on the banking system. As European Banking Authority Chair Jose Manuel Campa described in June, potentially you get a vicious circle by which a bank sells protection to somebody that's been financed by another bank. The financial crisis of 2008 demonstrated that it's possible for dozens of interconnected financial firms to all have problems at once, renege on their commitments, and bring each other to the brink of ruin. And that is what just amazed me this morning. All this significant risk transfer, right? They're taking all this money from these hedge funds and they're setting it aside to cover their losses. When it's the banks themselves that are loaning that money to the hedge funds to begin with. So if the loans default and the bank seizes the money that's in the synthetic risk transfer, then the hedge fund loses the money. The hedge fund can no longer pay their loan that they used to borrow that money in the first place from the same freaking bank or from a similar bank. And if they all have the problems at the same time, it won't matter which bank. Oh my God, this is such degenerate garbage. Guys, be careful. That's all I can tell you. The increasing complexity of the fraud, you can see it in real time. Meanwhile, Thailand launched airstrikes at Cambodia as border tensions reignite. Look, World War III, there we go. All these little regional conflicts just keep flaring up. The risk is that all these small brush fires combine into one raging inferno. This one flared up earlier this year. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it because we've already been going for about 40 minutes here. This one flared up earlier this year. President Trump claimed to have negotiated a ceasefire. He bragged about it in the press. Well, now it's flared up again. This is a longstanding border dispute. Probably, hopefully doesn't escalate into all-out war. But yeah, more shooting, more killing. And hey, I just want to say thank you very much to SWFL Buck, he says, AI, new executive, one rule, AI. Man, dude, the space bar is injecting itself. Okay, a new executive, one rule, AI order, communism. Mish and I were talking about this one this morning as well. President Trump is expected to issue an executive order today that is supposedly going to create one AI regulatory framework to rule them all, right? We'll call it the precious. Here's the thing. We've seen this with AI executive orders. When President Trump can't get something done legislatively, he issues an executive order. He holds up the portfolio for everybody. He has his signing ceremony. Some industry a-hole will be standing over his shoulder when he does it, maybe Secretary Lutnick. What it's probably going to be is it's going to be an executive order directing the Secretary of blank to issue a framework policy proposal within 100 days, establishing a consistent framework across the whole country for AI. He's trying to prevent states from issuing their own in-state AI regulatory frameworks. He's not going to be able to do that without Congress. He can issue an executive order to try to convince the market that this risk isn't a problem for them, but legally he just can't do that, right? Unless it is specifically enumerated, it belongs to the states. And unless Congress actually passes a law establishing some single set of regulations for AI, which don't exist, the states are going to have control over it. So that's just my take on that. I think it's going to be largely a dog and pony show, which is why I didn't cover it this morning. Thank you very much, sir, for the super chat and support of the channel. He's back again. He says, TF, it matters money. TF, it matters. Money spread is five. Money spread in five bank. I can't figure out what that means. I'm sorry, brother. Money spread out in five banks. Maybe this is in reference to the synthetic risk transfers, that if we spread the risk out across five banks, then okay, maybe if there's a default and then the hedge fund loses their SRT money, then they default on their loan. It doesn't spread to all the other banks. But what happens if there are widespread defaults and these SRTs, which are increasingly popular, start to go bad in large quantities? Suddenly, it doesn't matter which bank has which SRT. They're all going bad at the same time. That's the risk with these synthetic risk transfers. Thank you very much, sir, for supporting the channel. Tom Dillon, thank you, sir, for the generosity. He says, funny how the Hollywood types are screeching communists when it comes to other people's money, then turn all F.A. Hayek when their income is threatened. Hypocrite commies are the worst. Look, Hollywood has two sets of ethics. They have the ethics that they put on display when they're patting themselves on the back at the award ceremonies, being stunning and brave and making their stupid speeches within the confines and the safety of an echo chamber where everybody agrees with them. They're very vocal in that environment. However, when their money is at risk, for example, censorship in China, for example, anonymously signing a letter because they're afraid of retaliation from Netflix, when their money is at risk, they sing a different tune. Yep, we've seen that. They are absolutely hypocrites, right? Saying something in a room full of people who agree with you is not stunning and brave, right? It's actually incredibly easy. Saying something in a room full of people who disagree with you, that requires balls. These people don't have them. Thank you very much, Tom Dillon, for supporting the channel, sir. I appreciate that very much. Meow Meow 8873 says, if you look at the 8-packs, 10-Qs, and 13-Fs, okay, the 8-Ks, the 10-Qs, and the 13-Fs, these are the SEC filings documents of GameStop, you might see that it's the 10 in the ICK of all the stocks. In the DICK. Man, you guys are making this stuff hard on me this morning to read. I just can't tell what you're saying. All right. Look at the 10-Qs, the 8-Ks, and the 13-Fs for GameStop. All right. I'll look at those. I haven't looked at GameStop very closely recently, guys, to be honest with you. That story's kind of fallen by the wayside. I was a big proponent of the ape movement early on. I was very excited. I love the idea of the little guys getting together and kicking the big guys in the nuts. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. The big guys changed the rules in the middle of the game to rig the market so that they could win. And the story kind of fizzled out. I know there's a lot of people that are still clinging to that one, but I think that one has fallen by the wayside here. They're doing the same thing with silver again, too. You can see it with Bob Coleman has done an excellent job pointing out how you see a big spike in failures to deliver of SLV shares leading up to options expiration. So they're letting people short without having shares to back it, artificially inflating the supply of SLV shares. Then options expire worthless. Then SLV creates the shares in order to deliver against those shorts, and then the price starts to rise, but only after the options have expired worthless. It's a way for them to avoid a gamma squeeze in SLV affecting the underlying silver price. We've seen this story. We've seen this game before. Thank you very much, Meow Meow. Appreciate the super chat and support of the channel. Hunt and Cover says, putting in my 2 cents worth to account for inflation. Thank you very much, sir, for your 2 cents. I appreciate that very much. Thank you for supporting the channel. And thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button on the way out for the YouTube algorithm, should you feel so inclined. Also, thank you very much for all the super chats, guys. I appreciate that. And my magnanimous Melonheads on Patreon, YouTube, and Buy Me a Coffee. Thank you, guys, for supporting the channel. Appreciate that. Links down below, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.